Hunter.
Hi guys, it's Jess here with the I Am Hunter podcast. Tash and Dad and I today are going to be talking to Willem Gertenbach. He's our outfitter in South Africa. We're going to be having a chat with him about some of the common questions that we've had about hunting in Africa, what it's really like, some of the common misconceptions about hunting in Africa, and then just chatting to him about his personal experience. So I hope you guys enjoy. We're going to get on the phone to him now.
Okay, we've just got Willem here on the phone with us, and we're about to go through a few questions around what it's like to hunt in South Africa, what you can expect when you hunt in South Africa, but also some of the conservation details and the, I guess, some of the issues that are faced in and around South African hunting. But to kick it all off, how about we ask Willem to give us a bit of an understanding about how you got into hunting in the first place, mate?
Well, hi, Rob. Yes, thanks for the opportunity. I guess, you know, living in Africa and South Africa specifically, you pretty much get born into it. It's not something you decide you want to do. It's just something you've always done. Since I was a little boy, I can remember, you know, just going out shooting small animals, the rock rabbits and meerkats and stuff like that, you know. So there's just so much freedom out here when it comes to that. You know, we don't have a specific age where you can start hunting. You don't have to have a hunting license for Australia. So your dad pretty much teaches you gun safety and off you go. And that's how you start, and hopefully you stick with it.
Right. So has that changed now? I mean, are they bringing in kind of licenses for kids and stuff like that? That's what we've got that condition over here now.
And it never used to be that way. I mean, I think it's important to say that here in Australia, it used to be the very same, that like when Dad was a kid, you know, you didn't need a license to do that kind of stuff. You went out trapping and trapping rabbits and stuff like that, and ferreting and all sorts. And you didn't need to worry about any of that kind of stuff because it was so common back then that, you know, everyone helped to, the local farmer would be happy to show you around, you know, show you about hunting and things like that and teach you about it. Your dad would, you know, your uncles would and all sorts. So whereas nowadays they've really restricted that now. So it's a lot harder, like for me with my son, you know, 4.5 years old, to be able to take him out to the range. You're actually not supposed to do it. You know, you're not supposed to be letting them handle that kind of stuff until they're, I think it's 12 here in Tassie. So it's a lot harder to introduce them at a young age so that they start to learn about some of the responsibility around it and all the things that I'm sure you learned when you were really young as a kid. You've got to wait until they're 12 or 13 to do that now. So is that how it's gotten in South Africa as well, or is it still very much open and allowed?
We've got to pretty much distinguish between city kids and kids living out in the rural areas like we do, living out on a farm. You know, I mean, take yesterday, for instance, Archie is 14 years old. Yesterday, he took a 12-gauge shotgun and came back with a friend, you know, so he just went out on his own and shot something. But saying that, you know, I don't think the opportunity is there for the city dwellers as much as it is for the kids growing up on the farms. So I think probably you would want, if you live in a city, you would want your kid to go through some kind of a school or schooling system just to teach the guys, you know, the basics. I don't think that's wrong, but saying that, guys living out on the farms, you know, the kids, they just, it's still the way it used to be.
Yeah,
right. Okay. And what about, so how long have you been working as a professional hunter in that capacity?
I've been guiding professionally from 2002. I started pretty late in my working career. I had a normal job before that, if any job's normal. This job's normal, I don't know. But yeah, it's just something I always wanted to do, something I've always dreamed of. Thanks a lot, I got the opportunity to eventually do it and eventually start my own company. But I've been, you know, pretty much guiding since 2002.
Has it changed much over the years from when you first started to now?
That's quite a lot. Over the years, the whole hunting industry has become a very competitive industry. Good and bad to that, you know, there's a lot of the real hunting was gone out of the back door and was replaced with just economics at some stage for some of the people. I still believe that hunting comes first, and if you do it well, you'll probably make a little bit of money out of it in any case.
Yeah.
I don't want to use the word ethical hunting, but, you know, real hunting, I would say.
So more about the experience than just about going over there and shooting something and paying the money for it. You know, you want to provide people with that real experience.
You know, I had a look at the meaning of the word safari. If you Google that, you know, it's a journey. And exactly what it is. It's such a good explanation of what hunting out here is. You know, it's not just about shooting stuff. It's a whole journey. It's about, you know, looking forward to coming over and the excitement of setting foot on Africa for the first time and then getting to the hunting area and seeing the first animals and what have you. You know, it's a whole journey. You know? Sometimes, especially on the dangerous stuff, I've found that the actual killing part of it is almost like an anticlimax at the end of the day. You know, once it's done, it's done.
Yeah.
But even so, it's just a whole journey, you know, and you've got to take everything in.
I think that's one of the common...
With you guys, you know, where you've got a whole different culture up there, and you've got to take everything in to get the full experience.
Yeah, I agree.
I think it's one of the common misconceptions that people have. They seem to think that, especially people who are on the side of not liking hunting and actively not liking hunting, they think that, you know, these hunters, they pay their money, they travel over to Africa, they get off the plane, get in the car, travel off to the hunting location, get out, shoot
that animal, and go. Bang,
yeah. You know. And it's like they just don't, and you don't understand it until you've been over there and done it yourself. And, you know, we've done this, so we know that you get over there and the minute you get off the plane, the experience starts. You know, the culture's completely different. The landscape is completely different. The people are different. Everything about it, you know, the way that people live, the makeup of the people over there and all sorts, you know, seeing the markets on the sides of the roads where they're selling fruit and things like that, all that kind of stuff. It's things that you don't experience here in Australia. And they just don't get it that it's that whole journey that is what makes us love hunting so much. It's not that we're these bloodthirsty people that just want to go out and kill an animal, you know. If we wanted to do that, we all would have got a job in an abattoir if it was the killing that we liked so much. But it's the actual experience, the journey of going over there, you know, and experiencing all these different things with you guys. Like I know when we went over there with you last year and hunted, probably one of my most memorable and favorite parts of the entire hunt was seeing Shucks, our tracker, tracking down that zebra. You know, seeing him in his element, doing what he does best, and it was just amazing to see.
That's one thing, you know. It's something you can't experience anywhere else in the world. First of all, there's the sheer number of animals we've got over here. You know, I had a look at some figures. If we talk about conservation, in 1964, there was an estimate of about 575,000 wild animals in South Africa. And that's when the hunting industry pretty much started, where people started protecting wild animals opposed to just shooting them out to make space for cattle and sheep.
If I can just stop you there for a second, Vellum, because that's a really, like, that's such an important thing to understand that people quite often don't get just that very simple statement that if those animals, in order for them to exist, there has to be some reason. Otherwise, that land is owned by somebody and that land is either going to be tilled or used for cattle and sheep. And those animals are going to compete, so they're not going to survive. They're going to be just shot and killed. That is an absolute fact.
If it wasn't for the wildlife industry, you know, just to put this in perspective, in 64, 575,000 wild animals in where we're standing now, there's an estimate of 24 million native wild animals in South Africa.
Wow.
And that's just because people realize, you know, there's unfortunately, you know, if you put a value to anything, you're going to look after it.
Yeah.
So people started moving away from agriculture in some of the more arid areas and the more outback kind of areas, moving away from agriculture and moving over to what we refer to as game farming. And that's why we've got so many, you know. I mean, simple as that. There's like 20 million hectares of land. That's three times more land than what the state in private countries or in state-owned game reserves.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the whole conservation effort for hunting and because of hunting is enormous. It's ginormous, you know, it's unbelievable.
And the sheer weight of numbers that have increased as a result of having a viable industry, a hunting industry, that's kept those animals alive. I mean, the sable's probably one of the best examples of that, the sable antelope. And you know, that having almost been extinct back in those, like the 60s and 70s, I certainly know I read that at some stage they were listed with CITES as an endangered species. Now they're, of course, well off that list. They're, you know, there's so many of them. They're now just, you know, pretty much considered another antelope that you could hunt if you wanted to.
Well, the big thing is, you know, it's all about sustainable and responsible utilization of these animals. And you're quite right in saying that, you know, a lot of the endangered species were reintroduced to areas where they were pushed out because of agriculture. And the numbers are way up, you know, to such an extent that we can hunt them again today. You know?
Yeah.
It's just a huge effort from everybody in the wildlife industry.
Yeah. So on the back of that, and this is a bit of a curly one, because and I'm sure you've seen it too, where somebody has like the example I've got is one of the female hunters last year or the year before hunted a giraffe, a black giraffe or a dark giraffe. And of course somebody put a spin on it and said, oh, that's a it's a rare species, it's an endangered animal, you know. And of course this went around the internet, went nuts. And she got slammed by, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of people about this thing. And of course we know, you know, giraffes for starters aren't endangered. And second of all, the black ones or the darker ones aren't rare. Yeah, that's right. It's old, which for a hunter is actually the ones you're trying to get, because generally they're the ones that are no longer a part of an active herd. In other words, they're not going to procreate, you know, or they're at the end of their procreation.
Unfortunately, you know, a lot of people in today's day and age, it's so easy to make a comment, and once you've made the comment or the statement, you've made it, you know, on social media, whether that being fact or not. Yes, of course, there is giraffe species endangered. They're way up in Kenya. They're not down here.
Species
all together. We've got 36 huntable species just in South Africa. I'm not even talking about the rest of Africa, Sub-Sahara, you know, on this continent. Give you another good example is the zebra. We shoot virtual zebra down here, which is not endangered. If you go up to Tanzania and Kenya, you've got the grevies, which is endangered. You know, so people get it wrong. For them, a zebra is a zebra, giraffes are giraffe.
Yeah.
But just to go back to the black bull situation, those giraffe bulls, when they're really old, they actually turn black. So it's not a subspecies or a different animal. It's just still a regular giraffe. And they're definitely not endangered in South Africa.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny, though? Isn't it funny that it's always the people who claim to care the most about animals that know the least about them? You know, they make these off-the-hand comments and off-the-cuff comments on social media, not understanding the reality of the situation, claiming to care so much about animals, you know, and not actually knowing anything specific about them.
Yeah, you know, I said to my stance in the week, I said to them, there's a couple of people you can't reason with. You know, you can't reason with somebody who's drunk. and you can't reason with any activist because they can't listen. There's something wrong with them, you know. They don't want to listen. And the question you can ask is, you know, what have they done since 1964 to increase animal numbers? What have they done to somehow help poverty in rural areas where there's no hunting? It's just, I don't know why you make those comments, you know. It's just, I think sometimes it's just to make themselves look good or whatever it is, I don't know. But I try not to get involved with those people or conversations with those people because it's just senseless.
Is there anything that you would say to the people that are calling for a ban of hunting in South Africa?
Well, what they should do is, I will invite them to come over here. They don't have to hunt. I will just take them around. And they can see what it's like, and I will explain to them what's going to happen if hunting stops. All the animals they will see, we will be back to 500,000 animals within a couple of years.
So 25 and a half million animals will be killed,
exactly,
in order for livestock to survive, because that will become the viable option.
No, not just that, Rod, you know, that's one side of the coin. But if you take the footprint of the average outfit, you've got the outfit on top, you've got these CHs, you've got a guy feeding the vehicles, you've got a skinner, you've got a tracker, you've got staff cleaning the accommodation, doing the laundry, you've got a chef. So you're looking at, you know, just for an average small outfit or per group, probably about 10 people involved in the whole process. Now, we're not even talking about the taxidermy, you know, then that's another part of it, you know. So it's a huge footprint that will just disappear.
Yeah.
So in terms of people, if the antis want to create poverty in the world by stopping hunting, that's exactly what they will achieve. People won't have jobs.
Yeah.
And to get a job down here is not that easy.
That's what I think they just don't understand, you know, about this land use thing. It's like the land is there and it's owned by people, like you said. It's not owned by the government. It's owned by private individuals, and they've got to make a living off that somehow. And I think it's a problem with people who live in these cities. They think, oh, well, you know, I just go to my job at my office and they don't live off the land at all. They don't rely themselves at all on the land. Yeah, for what they make as their money for their family to survive. So they don't understand that there are people out there who are actually, that is their very survival, is what they can make off the land. And if you can't make that through farming game animals and wild game species, then you've got to make that some other way. And as Dad said earlier, you know, that's often either agriculture, you know, through farming crops or through farming livestock, you know. So then at that point, the wild animals get pushed off. It's not this Lion King scenario where just because we're not hunting, the land goes back to this, you know, wonderful bliss oasis where Rafiki's holding up Simba and everybody's good friends with each other. You know, they just don't understand.
The good Lord only gave us so much land, and that's it. You know, whatever we do with it is up to us.
Yeah.
It's really a choice, you know, whether you want to go the agriculture way or go the wildlife way, whatever the situation is, like you rightfully said, you know, somehow you've got to pay the bills. And for me, it's a total disaster if they ever manage to stop hunting in total. You know, it's just crazy. I've had to look at some numbers as well. You know, in Kenya, their wildlife population decreased by 85% since they stopped hunting and just changed over to tourism.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I read some stuff about I read some stuff myself about Botswana as well when they stopped elephant hunting over there, and I know that's a very contentious, you know, topic to bring up elephant hunting at all, because most people go straight off the rails as soon as you mention something like that. But Botswana have just reinstated it for a number of reasons, but one of the main reasons is the elephants are actually killing off all of their own normal and natural wildlife. Because they're eating them out of house and home. They're not only killing humans, but they're killing the other animals in the areas because there's now a population that they can't maintain.
They destroy habitats. That's what elephants do. Botswana, and I'm not sure the exact figure, but they've got more than 300,000 elephants. We've got about, I think, 16,000 at the moment in South Africa. We can't sustain more than 8,000 in Kruger.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're in trouble as well. If you go to the northern border of Kruger National Park, you can see the damage they've done already. You know, they push over all the big old marula trees and what have you.
Yeah.
They destroy habitats. So the bushbuck and the nyala won't have any food because of the elephant. And if you take the number of elephants hunted every year, it's a very, very, very small percentage of the total population. In fact, I think there's more elephants are being poached than what's hunted.
Well, I was reading about the reopening of elephant hunting in Botswana, and one of the things that they spoke about is that even though they're reopening that to try and create income, and that's one of the primary reasons they've done it, to create income from hunters in order to pay for other habitats for the animals where the elephants have destroyed those areas. And they believe it's the only way they can sustainably afford to do it. But still, they're saying that they need to almost reduce the elephant population by at least half, which they don't believe just hunting will help now either, because they've got beyond, of course, this kind of tipping scale issue where the animals are now out of control and they're going to have to cull quite a few of them.
Yeah, the culling stopped in South Africa quite a number of years ago. They've stopped the cull in Kruger National Park. And it's a disaster. Even now, you know, elephant bull weighs 8 tons. So it's not a sheep you can quickly load on the back of a truck and go and process. You know, it's a huge operation to handle those animals.
Yeah.
But something will have to be done. You know, I don't have the answer for that. Just to shoot them out is not going to be that easy.
Mm.
But at least, you know, I'm glad they've opened hunting again. So at least the community, and I think that's where the pressure probably came from, is where the communities, I think they also run a system called Campfire, where the community gets a big share of the total hunt of the money of the hunt.
Yeah.
A negative portion of that goes back into the community, and the outfit who runs the concession is going to, you know, sometimes I know in Mozambique you've got to build a school or supply maybe a borehole or something like that to supply a little package of water. These are all things that are not told. So yes, you know, I don't know. The elephant problem in Africa is far bigger than what people think it is, you know. If you just go down to the duty block in the south of Botswana, it's destroyed.
So you were saying, you were saying that that you think that more elephants get poached than actually get hunted in South Africa. How does actually hunting stop poaching or help stop poaching?
Okay, in South Africa, the poaching problem is not that big here. In Mozambique, it's huge. And some of the neighboring countries, it's quite big. So what happens is, if you're a concession holder, you've got an anti-poaching unit pretty much going around, doing the rounds, and you've got people on the ground pretty much. Yeah? So if there's something going on, you can pick up on it and you can get the authorities to sort it out or what have you, or even your anti-poaching unit can pretty much, you know, do something about it, even do a citizen's arrest if need be. So it's just the mere fact that you've got people on the ground and bunches. This is a little bit of reverse psychology some of the guys use. If they've got a hunting area, obviously they need animals in that area, and what they would do with the local villagers and the chiefs, they would tell them, okay, fine, obviously the meat goes to them, but if they find snakes and things like that, they stop it. So the budget pretty much stops, because everybody's going to be at a disadvantage because of one guy poaching, opposed to, you know, getting guys out for coming up, and they get the meat and they get some money out of it, and what have you. So they pretty much, you know, the old chief system is still, or tribal system is still working very fine. And that's the way you stop it. So yeah. It's the only way you can do it. The Ryan poaching is different, you know. I mean, there's so much money in it.
Yeah, so in terms of the actual with poachers, do you find that employment helps a lot? Like, do you find that there's more poaching in areas where hunting isn't allowed because they're not actually employed in the hunting industry and making an income out of that? I mean, in South Africa, quite a few of the locals are employed at outfits and things like that to help out as trackers and to help out in, you know, all throughout the outfit, as you said before. So that just that act of employment alone, does that help to reduce some of the poaching?
Yeah, of course. I mean, if you're employed and you get a steady income, why don't you put your own life at risk to go and shoot an elephant?
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about the elephant killing you. I'm talking about the anti-poaching shooting you.
Mm. Yeah. You know, so, citizen's so arrest.
and you get pretty much a reasonable income out of it, and you can look after your family, and this guy, you know, still provides you with meat in the season and the rest of it. Why would you want to go out and put your own life and your family's life at the risk by going and poaching? The biggest and the most effective way to stop it is just through campfire. And campfire is a very successful model. We brought our white rhino population from almost extinction back to great numbers in KwaZulu-Natal. And this was done by Ian Player. He pretty much, you know, developed this whole model whereby the community benefits so much and what have you. So, of course, you know, if we don't hunt, those animals will disappear. We will not have elephants, we will not have rhinos, and a whole lot of other stuff.
Yeah. So you're talking about them getting the meat. I mean, obviously, we've been over to Africa ourselves, and so we know that the process after you actually shoot an animal, that everything goes and gets used, and it's very well managed how the meat gets used. Can you just explain a little bit for the listeners what happens after an animal goes down, where the meat actually goes, and what happens with it? Because I think a lot of people have a general misconception around it, that you go trophy hunting in Africa and so all you're there for is the head and that nothing else gets used.
You can tell them about my requests, Willem, whenever I come over there to always get some of the meat.
Yeah, if Rod comes over, then he eats everything. No, you know, obviously when that group comes over, if the animal's shot, we pretty much put it on the back of the truck and it goes to a slaughtering facility where it's gutted and caved and the rest of it, and the meat goes to a cold room. And from there, it goes to the informal trade. You know, obviously the guys on the specific concession, but sometimes I can't use everything. You know, there's just much too much of it. So the balance of it will go into the informal trade. So it's not thrown out for the jackal and the hyenas. It's everything's consumed. You know, everything's done in a proper hygienic manner. And of course, you know, in camp we use quite a bit of it. We use quite a lot of it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a nice, I can not use it.
Yeah. Do you sell a lot of it back to butchers and things like that for them to make?
The meat that's not consumed in camp pretty much goes into the informal trade at a fraction of what protein costs you. You know, depending on the area, in some areas you can't even move the meat, and that will go straight out into the community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To give you an example, we shot a hippo once in Mozambique. When we shot the hippo, we were only three people. It was just me and the client and one tracker. When by the time we got it out of the water, there were maybe 10 people.
Who done the carry out, Villain?
Registered off, and 130 people got food that night.
110.
Wow.
130 people got food that night.
Oh,
just to hear the drums playing until 4 a.m. They hate the whole damn thing, but I mean they had to because they don't have prison facilities.
Yeah.
A whole hippo was eaten in one night. It was 130 people.
By 130 people, yeah.
Wow. Hippos are pretty big.
That's amazing. Changing tact a little bit, Willem, and asking you a bit more of a personal question. Obviously, you take people hunting, but I'd expect you do a little bit of hunting still yourself.
Right, you know, yes, I do. It's funny how certain things start to tickle you. I guess the obvious is the crazy you get, you know. I'm on the draft and maybe trying to get a tiny thing or something like that. As for normal stuff, it's a lot more fun for me to just watch the boys, my two sons, hunt nowadays than what I do. But, I think it's not shooting. I love just being out there, out in nature, and just observing to see what there is, and helping make decisions on management of the property over time. So it's not about going out and shooting something, but in terms of, you know, still hunting, yeah, I've got my list of things to do.
Just so, if you do go for the tiny 10, just don't take Dad with you, because we know how bad his luck is with them.
Look, I was taking for anything except a tiger.
Yeah, anyway, that's for another podcast.
Just coming back to that, we've got such a diversity of animals, you know, it's unbelievable. I try to explain that to people from the Northern Hemisphere, what they've got in their fisheries, like the Canadian fisheries and the Alaskan fisheries. We've got that in wild animals in this country. You know, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
You guys experience it, you know, you go after something and then other things pop up in front of you. You know, you try and get a zebra, but you can't get to it because it's like 15 ball in front of you or 15 ball and 20 villagers. You know, it's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. On the food, one other thing I wanted to ask you too is, it's something that we've been quite surprised with, I think, is some of the reaction over what people would eat. So to clarify, people think that livestock is the only option for meat that you would eat as a protein. So some of, I think, the problem and the misunderstanding around what gets used when you go and so-called trophy hunt is they think that you wouldn't eat it because it's not beef.
Yeah, you just take the head and you leave it on the ground.
Do you find, like in Africa with the locals and things like that, and the people that actually end up with the meat, is there any animals that they refuse that you guys hunt and they say, no, we're not going to eat that? Or will they eat anything? I mean, protein's protein to them.
Well, most of the animals we shoot, you know, it's normal plains game for the best part of it. And they consume pretty much everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's not one animal that they wouldn't eat. You know, you might get one guy who doesn't like zebra, for instance, but if that's what's available, then obviously he will eat it, you know. It's just not a good deal for them. I've had a guy who shot a lion once, and he insisted on having lion. I did not join in that feast, but, you know.
It's a privilege of modern society, I think, that we feel like we have these choices, you know, where we can choose to eat certain animals, we can choose to eat certain meat. But when you're living in countries that aren't quite so privileged, they eat what they're given, you know, they eat what comes to them and what's available, and they don't complain about it, they don't whinge about it. It's only really in more privileged societies where you get them starting to get picky and go, well, no, I think I'm only going to eat lamb, I'm only going to eat beef.
One of the unsaid things nowadays as well is that, like beef, lamb, even pork, it's now quite expensive. You know, it's around the world, it's an expensive meat. All three of those, you know, people nowadays are choosing cuts and types of cuts and marbling and all this other kind of stuff, and you know, they've become very picky about how they want that particular type of meat presented. But where, you know, game meat. And this is one of the things I always find funny, because people say, oh, game meat. Oh, I'm not eating game meat, mate, you know. And
that's going to taste gamey.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's going to taste gamey. Well, you just said it, mate. It's game meat, you know. But in actual fact, if you deal with it correctly, like you guys do over in South Africa, you hang it, you age it, you know, you allow it that time, just like normal beef and normal, you know, lamb and whatever, you know, it tastes bloody great. There's no issue with it whatsoever.
I always find it funny because it's like, you know, it's actually the hunters who really aren't fazed about eating anything. I mean, we go after, especially the separation between meat and then trophy hunters, right? A meat hunter will go for the youngest, often a doe or maybe a young buck, to try and get the nice, tender, soft, you know, well-flavored meat, yeah, and things like that. It's the trophy hunter who will go for the old gnarly bull, kill it, and then eat it as well. So you've taken something that nobody else would choose.
Yeah.
Nobody else would choose if they were only hunting for meat. If you were solely hunting for meat, you know, it's not something that you would go after. But we're taking those animals and then bringing them home and eating them anyway. I've always found that really funny.
I mean, how bad was the sight of you? Yeah, it was terrible. You couldn't chew it. It was so tough as boots. You know, it's damn good stuff.
It's it was beautiful.
You can't beat it.
That sable didn't even get aged.
In this country, you know, like Gemsbok and Eland and Seidel and Rodents and those things are, it's just excellent meat. It's just really, really, really good stuff, you know. And I think it's just perception. And I think the fact that we've got so many choices when you go to the supermarket just got people a little bit, a little bit crazy, I think.
Spoiled.
People don't know where it comes from. That's half the problem, you know. I mean,
yeah.
Water comes out of a tank, milk comes out of a box, and meat comes off a shelf. So,
yeah. And that before that, it was in the mince tree.
Where no animals were harmed.
I think in the old days, and I don't know what it's like in Australia, when you still had real butcher shops, it was probably a little bit better. But today, it's just, I don't know, it's a big grinding mill, you know. If you go in there and pack your stuff in a trolley and that's how you hunt.
Yeah.
I think there's been a little bit of a swing back, probably just in the last few years here, where you've got more of these kind of little artisan, you know, specialty shops popping up and delicatessens and things like that popping back up that you used to have. That was where you used to have to go to 3 or 4 different places to get all of your groceries. You couldn't go to one supermarket and get everything that you needed. And then you had things like Coles and Woolworths here in Australia popping up, and they became this monopoly where they just captured everything, and you had to go there to get everything that you needed. And now there's a little bit of a pushback, you know, where people want to be a little bit more connected to where their food is coming from. And so I think that's why we're actually starting to see a bit of a growth in hunting now, because people want to know where it comes from. People want to actually have a hand in that.
Yeah, look, I think you know, the word trophy thing is just a misconception altogether. You know, it's not just about the horns on an animal. It's about a whole lot of other things. You know, like you rightly said, the meat gets consumed by whoever shot it and a lot of other people in the whole process. You know, so. And it's pretty good meat, you know, considering that we are shooting the elderly.
Yeah.
And the old and ugly.
Make it sound like we're just walking into a nursing home. The older animals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we've got the same problem here, you know, where some people only do jerky or bolt-on game meat. Until they realize how good eating it is.
Yeah.
Especially if, you know, if you shoot them early in the season and they're still nice and fat and what have you, it's the best.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if it's going organic, can you get better meat than game meat?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't get much more organic.
Yeah. Bill, I know you're kind of a bit pressed for time, mate. You're gonna want to head off shortly. So
barbecue.
Yeah, can I ask you one last question? And this has got to do with, I guess, just common perception, because a lot of hunters out there, and we get this feedback often ourselves, they feel that you know, in order to hunt Africa, they're going to have to sell a kidney or you know, kind of donate a limb or something like this in order to get over there, and it's going to cost them a fortune. And then I guess the added bit to that is they're concerned about the type of hunting, whether it's going to be considered canned or not, and all this kind of stuff. I mean, we've hunted there a few times, and with you, and we've known you for 10 years, so we share the story. But it would be nice to hear from you about what your thoughts are as far as that's concerned.
Look, I think let's just address the hyping situation or issue. I know that's quite a burning issue for some people. got to realize that there's certain diseases carried by wild animals in this country. And it's also part of the conservation effort is to have those hybrids because that gives the landowner ownership of the animals and pretty much forcing him to protect them.
Yeah.
But saying that, I do not hunt in little pens, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
The hunt is still real. And if you're talking about the high fenced area, if an area is 50,000 hectares, is that still considered being a pen or can or whatever the case may be? You know, how long is the string of this whole thing? I would not hunt the area of a client that I will not myself hunt.
Yeah.
If I'm talking hunting, I'm talking real, the real deal. So just covering that, it's pretty much. Unfortunately, we have to keep wildebeest away from cattle because they do carry disease.
The bovine disease.
A lot of these animals can still move regardless. You know, I just had sables pitching up in my property a couple of weeks ago.
Right. Did you grab yourself a few nice backstraps?
I'm hunting in a week from now, I'm hunting one of them, so I will definitely have a backstrap.
It's the 30-day rule. Once you've had them for 30 days, they're yours.
Yeah, that's right. What about the expense, Willem?
I'll give it for Dash's baby.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of the cost, if you compare it to anywhere else in the world, you can probably shoot, I would say, 4 animals for how much it would cost to shoot one animal elsewhere. If I'm going to compare it to let's say a deer hunt or elk hunt in the United States, those things are, in my book, very expensive.
For what you get. Yeah.
Plus, if you don't shoot it, you're not going to pay for it.
Yeah.
A lot of outfitters in the rest of the world, as we know, they would charge you and charge you the full price even if you just went there and didn't even see the animal. You're still going to pay for it. I had a situation where I wanted to do a black bear in North America, and the guy asked me, well, first of all, you're going to put in for a draw, and then you're going to do this, and you're going to do that. I said, this is not going to work for me, And I said, well, what if I don't get it? Well, you're going to pay me the full amount now. And if you don't get it, I can't help you.
Wow.
We don't have that. We don't have that. The total cost, I don't think the trophy on your wall or animal on your wall or a flask, whatever you want, is just so much cheaper than what it could be anywhere else.
Even in terms of the taxidermy, we've found that, taxidermy in Africa is a lot cheaper than it is anywhere else.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we did labor, so it's a lot cheaper to do that. The guys do a lot of it, they back at the whole labor force, whereas in the rest of the world, unless it's a really big taxidermy shop where you're going to pay an arm and a leg to have the work done.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a couple of guys doing it, but yeah, you've got a crew of maybe even 50 people working there. That's all part of the whole hunting footprint. If it wasn't for hunting, those people wouldn't have been there.
How many people would you say, Willem, you've actually had through, though, that haven't got the animals that they were after or haven't left happy with the animals that they got? I mean, is it very likely to happen or is it something that's unlikely?
I don't know. It's very unlikely.
Depends if you ask someone about shooting dikers.
It depends if you ask Dad about shooting dikers.
Is something I don't even advertise anymore.
Was that because of Dad?
No, obviously it can happen with Dash, but isn't that hunting?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
There's
no guarantees.
Out of people who come here, just thinking back of guys who left us without something. I've never had one client leaving without anything, to be honest with you. I've had guys maybe wanting a specific species and maybe we couldn't get him what he really wanted, and he would have left without that specific animal or that specific species. But saying that, on that same safari, he might have shot five other species.
Yeah.
We've got to think what the bush keeps you as well. You know, you can't, this is still hunting, you know, you don't buy these things off a catalogue.
This is one of the things that I think is one of the absolute draw cards about Africa, is that you can go there and you can say, you know, oh, I've always wanted to hunt a kudu and I want to hunt a kudu. And you get over there and you get out in the bush and all of a sudden you've got, you know, 15 species that you see within the first 2 days of being there.
You're like, now I want to hunt a nyala, I want to hunt this.
But it just gives you that option because, like you said, you know, it is hunting. It's not shopping. So sometimes you've just got to take what you're given. But the benefit with Africa is that that can end up being something just as beautiful, if not more beautiful, than what you were going after in the first place. So you're not leaving with any lesson experience.
And the thing is, you know, let's say you want to come out let's say you want to shoot a nyala, and you come here and you've shot the nyala on, let's say, the second day of a 7-day safari, you know, then you can always shoot something else. It's not like, okay, so you can only shoot that one animal, now you've got to go and do whatever you want to do. And it's still affordable, you know. Even if you want some of the less expensive species, they keep you busy. I mean, you ran off the Nepal for God knows how long.
Yeah. And the zebra.
And the zebra, you know. So I think in terms of the integrity of what it is, it's 100% right there. And if you come out for a specific species and you happen to not get it, it's highly unlikely that would happen because, I mean, we do whatever we can and whatever we have to, staying positive in camp and, you know, making plans to try and get you whatever you really want. Go the extra mile to get the job done. It's not that likely that you would leave without what you want, you know, but I mean, obviously, it can happen. These things are not tied down, that they live wherever they live. So, yeah.
I mean, we almost went without the nyala this time, so
that was because somebody refused to pick up a rifle.
Damn bow hunters.
I don't want to talk about the nyala because I saw some comment about, I believe I'm a camera problem or something.
I just wanted to make you feel better, okay?
She was trying to hide your mistake, Willem, and you just put it out there for the world to see. It's the one button you had to press, Willem, was record.
hey, he pressed record after it. Yeah. He pressed record after the shot, and then he got everything else.
All right, Willem. We'll let you go anyway. Off to your barbecue. We don't want to hold you up from your family. So thank you so much for having a chat with us and for clearing up some of those things and just, you know, giving people a better idea of what it's actually like on the ground in Africa.
You know what, Jess, I just want to make one last comment. And that's if you haven't been here, you should really try and come over here and see what it's like and just experience it. It's an unbelievable continent, unbelievable people with unbelievable opportunities.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. That's why I keep coming back.
Perfect note to leave it on because we all second that.
Yeah.
It's my favorite place to hunt.
You know, just looking at the stats, 80% of all people who have hunted here do come back. So I think that in itself tells a story.
All right, mate.
I'm going to say goodbye. I've got to go because Mazelle's on my back here.
You don't want to make the wife angry.
Thanks for taking the time, mate. We'll catch you again soon.
No worries. I'll speak to you guys soon.
Bye, Bill. Bye. All right, thanks for listening, guys. I hope that cleared up some of the questions that you might have had about hunting in Africa. If you do have any others, please make sure to let us know and we'll be happy to answer them and do some more of this for you.
And don't mind Tash fumbling over a question. She's not very good at reading.
She likes to claim she has dyslexia, but it's never actually been proven. I think she might just be a little bit slow.
And that whole diker issue, I have actually shot a diker.
A female diker.
I've shot a male too.
He did shoot a male.
I shot a male.
It just got lost in transit, so no one's ever seen it.
Yeah.
Anyway, guys, make sure that you keep up with us on Instagram and Facebook. Thanks for listening.